This morning, the Old Mole Repertory Theater Players present a radio drama starring Luisa Martinez as a longtime bureaucratic functionary in a government agency or NGO concerned with climate change, and me as a young, naive radio personality who thinks I know more than I actually do. The setting is a KABU studio, maybe around the year 2035, and we're broadcasting live. It's clear that Luisa's character is disdainful, thinks that no good can come of our interview, and that I am wasting her important time. This drama is actually a chapter in an important book I want to tell you about, Kim Stanley Robinson's The Ministry for the Future. Here, then, is our drama.
Today, we're here to discuss potential alternatives to the global neoliberal order, which seems to be in such imminent danger of collapse. Are there any already existing alternatives we can look to?
China, obviously.
But China seems very deeply implicated in the global economy.
They have a command economy that overrules the free market to bolster Chinese interests.
That's so interesting. What could we call such a mysterious new amalgam?
Socialism.
Oh my. How very transgressive of you, not to say nostalgic. But I seem to recall that China is always careful to add the phrase "with Chinese characteristics" whenever they use the word socialism. And it seems to many that those Chinese characteristics make for a completely new thing.
Yes, but no.
You don't agree?
No, it's socialism with Chinese characteristics.
These characteristics, including a huge dollop of capitalism, it seems.
Yeah.
So might we learn things from them?
No.
How come?
Because we don't like them.
Isn't that rather prejudiced of us?
They don't like us either.
So, no hope of change from that quarter. What about the poor? The 4 billion poorest people alive have less wealth than the richest 10 people on the planet. So they're not very powerful, but no one can deny that there are a lot of them. Might they force change from below?
There are guns in their faces.
What about the so-called precariat then? Those middle billions just scraping by, what Americans still call the middle class, speaking of nostalgia. Could they rise up and change things by way of some kind of mass action?
Guns in their faces too.
And yet we do sometimes see demonstrations, sometimes quite large ones.
Demonstrations are parties. People party and then go home. Nothing changes.
Well, but what about coordinated mass action? That sounds like more than partying to me. The so-called fiscal strike that we hear so much about, leading to a financial crash and the subsequent nationalization of the banks, for instance. National governments would then be back in control, coordinating a complete takeover of global finance. They could rewrite the WTO rules and create some kind of quantitative easing, giving new fiat money to Green New Deal type causes.
We call that legislation.
So again, we come back to legislatures. These are usually thought to be features of representative democracies. To the extent that such democracies still exist, if they ever did, their legislatures would have to be voted in by voting majorities by definition, 51% at the least, or more, if possible, in all major countries where such systems obtain. They would all have to join the plan.
Yeah.
So this seems quite practical. What keeps us from doing that?
People are stupid. Also, the rich will fight it.
Again, this presumption that the rich have more power than the poor.
Yes.
But might it also be the case that there would be some kind of systemic resistance to change also, in that all these laws that need to change are intertwined and therefore can't be easily disentangled?
Yes.
You could even say that money itself would resist this change. Indeed, it seems to be the case that there's simply a kind of inherent, inbuilt resistance to change.
Constipation is a bitch. Sometimes you just have to sit on the box and push harder.
Well put. I guess you could call that the story of our decade, or the entire century for that matter.
Why stop there?
Such a trenchant image for history, I must say.
Tremendous relief when all that stuff is out of you.
No doubt. Well, that about wraps it up for this week. Perhaps it's time to pull down our pants and have a seat. I invite everyone listening to join us next week, this same time.
It might take longer.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you, my co-star, Luisa Martinez. That was a reading, maybe even a dramatic reading, of Chapter 38 in Kim Stanley Robinson's 2020 novel, The Ministry for the Future. Robinson is an important author for us here at Another World is Possible, because the question of possibility underlies so much of his work. Plausible social transformation towards something good is difficult to pull off in fiction. Authors find it easier to write about a society where the big change has already occurred. The protagonist may fall asleep and wake up sometime in the utopian future, their and our curiosity, supposedly satisfied with a few lines or paragraphs about a revolution that happened while they were sleeping. Or their boat, or plane, or spaceship may stray off course and land them in a wonderful or better hidden society with little apparent need to explain how the society came about. Those authors aim to show that something better could exist, that another world is possible, but don't give many clues for how we might actually get there. Kim Stanley Robinson is different. His Red Mars trilogy goes into, for me, excruciating details about how a more decent society might be constructed where there was no society before. Excruciating because he's obsessed with technicalities about how to organize a transport vessel and how to produce food where it's not been done before, as well as the social, economic, and political factors that are the context for the technicalities and primarily interest me. But the point is, he's trying to give us a path forward, show us persuasively how things could happen, and also the obstacles we would face, the resistance existing power structures could be expected to pose. Robinson's book, The Years of Rice and Salt, is a counterfactual history. What the last 600 years would have looked like on a worldwide scale, if the Chinese, rather than Europeans, had colonized the Americas. This is not a utopia, not a simplistic feel-good vision. Class struggle was still a driving force in this alternative history. Empires still happened, and societies were still, in one way or another, hierarchical. But he shows significant differences and potentials. His point is that things could have been different, that the societies we get aren't somehow predetermined. His novel, Shaman, also creates alternative societies, this time going back to the Ice Age, to explore in detail how humans do and might adapt to the natural world. Robinson's novels are not big on character development, at least the ones I've read. Their strength, rather, is their insistence, their demonstration that other ways of organizing society, more humane ways of living, are possible. And sometimes that there even are steps that can be spelled out for how to get us there. Which brings me back to his latest, The Ministry for the Future, one of the most unusual novels I've read. It's heavily didactic, yet thoroughly engrossing. A big book of 106 chapters, nearly all of them short, There is a plot, but many chapters don't directly connect with it. There are riddles, short dramas like the one which Louisa and I just presented, and technical explanations, all in service to show how we might overcome the worst effects of climate change. Also to showing what we're in for as things get worse. And most important, again, it's an effort to sketch out a practical and plausible way forward. Robinson recognizes that all the problems we face are interrelated, from gender and racial inequities to climate refugees, imperialism to impoverishment, and that capitalism is at their root. His solutions range from geoengineering to currency reform. But these are more than suggestions. This is a novel, after all. Through his characters and plot, he shows how solutions could come about. Also, what resistances to those solutions are likely, and where in the society they'd be situated. This is an anti-capitalist novel, but not one that pays much attention to mass action. In Robinson's vision, change happens largely through decisions taken by elites. They may be forced to act, and popular movements may play a role, but he doesn't dwell on that role, and presents it mainly as one of protest, that is, negative reactions. Positive visions for Robinson come through elite institutions, like the organization named in the book's title, the Ministry for the Future. That's a new institution to be created. Power, in his vision, still rests with existing institutions, especially financial, but, crucially, they can be transformed under the pressure of events to take righteous action. He would have the world learn also from projects already underway, from the cooperatives of Mondragon, the communist-led state of Kerala in India, the Cuban Revolution. There's vastly more to say about this rich novel. Robinson does not pretend to have solved all social problems, but he's shown one concrete, plausible path forward and demonstrated once again that another world is possible. This has been Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO.